painful, slow labor of building power under surveillance and persecution. So I think what is important to always realize that Israel is interested in a weak Iranian civil society, as is Iran, as is the Iranian regime. And I think one thing I would like to add to what Jafar Panahi said is that the Iranian regime must lose any legitimacy it has, you know, in international eyes. The Iranian regime is not wanted by the people. And we must realize that this is a dictatorial force, and it is, you know, is not a legitimate, anymore a legitimate governing force.
Sahar Delajani, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Internationally acclaimed Iranian author, and you mentioned Jafar Panahi, and we're going to talk about him right now in the Oscar nominations. The 2026 Oscar nominations have just been released. Nominees include several films we've covered on Democracy Now! Ryan Coogler's film Sinners has been nominated for a record-breaking 16 times, including for Best Director and Best Picture. Also, Delroy Lindo for Best Supporting Actor and Michael Jordan. You can go to our website, Ryan Coogler's interview with us. Other Oscar nominees include The Voice of Hindrejob and It Was Just an Accident for Best International Feature Film, Jafar Panahi's film, and also for Short Film, Armed Only with a Camera, The Life and Death of Brent Renaud, for Best Short Documentary. You can visit democracynow.org to see our segments on all of these films. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query every third Saturday at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And I lose control, think I follow
home. And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a major ice storm is about to impact hundreds of millions of people across the country. A group of attorneys general bring a packed house to Portland as they talk about challenging President Trump. And why are more Native women at risk of dying as a result of pregnancy? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 22nd, 2026. I am Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Americans are facing a new ice-related threat. This time, millions of Americans are bracing for a storm. It's expected to bring extremes of snow, ice, and cold temperatures. KBOO's Josh Salem has this in-depth report.
Americans in a variety of regions across the United States are being told to prepare for a potentially catastrophic ice storm. Experts say that trees might be crushed and power lines knocked out, and residents of Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York City, and Boston are being told they might have enough snow to make travel nearly impossible. An estimated 100 million people have already been under some type of winter weather watch, warning, or advisory as of yesterday. The storm is expected to begin tomorrow and to continue through the weekend. It will probably bring heavy snow, freezing rain, and sleet. An atmospheric river could affect Texas and other states along the Gulf Coast, then continue across Georgia and the Carolinas before heading northeast. Forecasters say snow amounts could reach a foot or more in the I-95 major cities from D.C. to Boston. The Weather Service's Washington, Baltimore office said, quote, "The combination of heavy snow and ice, alongside prolonged, very cold temperatures, presents a unique and significant risk to life and property across virtually the entire region," end quote. Some southern cities, like Jackson, Mississippi, don't even own a snowplow. They may need to substitute other heavy machinery like small excavators to clear their roads. Other southern areas, like parts of Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, and Tennessee, are expected to have a half inch of ice accumulation, leading to snapped electrical lines and prolonged power outages. At least four major U.S. hub airports are in the path of the southern storm this weekend, with delays for both passengers and cargo expected: Dallas-Fort Worth, Atlanta, Memphis, and Charlotte. Other major airports on the East Coast could see delays later, as the storm heads northeast. Parts of at least 19 states in the storm's path were under winter storm watches by late yesterday, with many more watches and warnings expected. It's not just precipitation that's worrisome. Temperatures will be brutally low. A wind chill of minus 50 degrees is forecast for parts of northern Minnesota and North Dakota. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield hosted a packed town hall meeting 1 year after he filed his first lawsuit challenging Trump in the president's second term. Rayfield and the attorneys general of four other states gathered at Revolution Hall in southeast Portland. Their town hall's focus was on oversight of the federal government and the state's legal fights with the Trump administration.
More than a year ago, we listened as the current president sat there and talked about his agenda for the United States. You had attorneys and Department of Justices across this country recognizing that the way he wanted to do that, the executive orders violating the Constitution, is not something that we were going to be able to put up with or stand, and our communities would be against that. And so you had AGs across this country preparing for that eventual moment. And more than a year ago today was the first lawsuit that was filed on behalf of citizens in all of the respective states. And that was a part of a partnership between all of us here. And this was our first win. And it was 72 hours after our first lawsuit that you had a judge in Washington, appointed by a Republican judge, giving our Democratic attorneys general our first win. Since then, here in Oregon, we filed more than 53 lawsuits. Those lawsuits have protected $4.6 billion and a continued trajectory of watching the federal government fold, have the money flowing back in, and winning a lot of these cases. Oregon had not been in the Supreme Court in more than 10 years, and we were here in the Supreme Court just this year on the tariffs case. And again, a lot of partnership with all the attorneys general here. So today really marks that 1 year trajectory, talking about the impact of communities and frankly, a vision that we do not share with the president in the illegal ways that he's trying to move his agenda, from rolling back healthcare benefits, rolling back food assistance, to the ways that he's attacking communities across our country and trying to normalize the use of military in all of our respective states.
The other attorneys general joining Rayfield in Portland were Hawaii's Ann Lopez, Maine's Aaron Frey, Minnesota's Keith Ellison, and California's Rob Bonta.
Rob Bonta, California Attorney General, honored to be here in the great state of Oregon and city of Portland. Always proud to stand with my fellow attorneys general. We have created a wall of protection for our people across the state as attacks have come from the Trump administration, a legal fortress, protecting rights, protecting freedoms, protecting funding. And a year and a day ago, Trump took office and immediately started breaking the law, and he hasn't stopped. He has been blatant and brazen, consistent and frequent in his lawlessness. He is a repeat offender. He has trampled over the Constitution and violated the law time and time again, and we have met him at the bounds of his authority and said, you cannot cross this line. You can advance your agenda if you do it lawfully, and perhaps you have the most expansive power of any elected official on the face of planet Earth. But you can never, ever advance it unlawfully and hurt our people. And unfortunately, he's violated the law multiple times from the state of California's perspective. We've brought 54 lawsuits over the course of the last year. That's more than one per week. We have won 80% of the time. We've secured 12 final orders in cases, 35 preliminary injunctions and other forms of emergency relief. We protected $188 billion worth of federal funding that California was owed, Congress appropriated, and Trump unlawfully tried to block and stop. And we will continue to deliver. We've also protected things that are priceless. You can't put a monetary value on it. Things like your constitutional rights, the right to birthright citizenship, the right to vote. We have helped protect funding that allows the hungry to have food, the sick to have health care, children to have education, the homeless to have a home, a roof over their head. We've stood up for the vulnerable when Trump has attacked the vulnerable in a very visible public case, literally working overtime, breaking the law to take food away from the hungry. And we continue to fight. That's our place. That's our space. As we look back on a year, we've seen a president who should not be violating the law. Also not controversial that he should be held accountable when he breaks the law and hurts our states. And as we look at the year ahead, we've turned the corner into the new year, and I know my good friend A.J. Ellison from Minnesota will talk about this, but the unlawfulness has only escalated. It's gotten worse. And our job, our role on the front lines, the first and last line of defense, in the trenches, sleeves rolled up, heads down, fighting for our people is more important than ever. And I'll just end where I started, an expression of a great deal of pride to be able to serve side by side with all my great attorneys general across the state, 23 Democratic attorneys general who have been fighting. Not one Republican AG has lifted a finger to protect the funding that's been ripped away from them and their people, or the right to protect the rights that have been stolen from them. But we have. And we like it when we are able to deliver nationwide injunctions, to deliver to the people in those red states where they don't have an attorney general who will stand up for them. But they deserve their rights to be protected. They deserve their funding to be protected. As we look ahead, we're going to continue to fight. We're all full of energy, got a full tank of gas, ready for whatever's next. A.G. Ellison from Minnesota.
All right. Let me thank my colleagues for all coming together here in the great state of Oregon. We all are very proud of Dan Rayfield, who in his first year has been remarkably productive and has been a leader among Democratic attorneys general. He has been active, he has been creative, he has been energetic, and I just want to let everybody in Oregon know that they were very smart when they elected Dan Rayfield. And we're working together. As I stand before you at this very hour, this minute, Minnesota, my beloved state, has seen a dramatic escalation in the number of immigration officers. Earlier, we looked at their escalation here. They are telling us that this is the biggest escalation. They've been working on LA, Portland, Chicago, and other parts, and now they're feeling pretty strong, and they've escalated to more than 3,000, maybe 3,500 immigration agents. But here's the problem. There are not 3,500 people who've committed serious felonies and who are not lawfully in the United States in the state of Minnesota. So because they have mismatched their complement of ICE agents with the task that they claim, getting the worst of the worst, they now have to occupy their time by doing other things, like throwing a chemical irritant under a car where an infant was so adversely affected that the parents needed to do CPR, and then after they got out of there, take the whole family to the hospital. Like shooting Renee Good, who was a woman who was trying to speak up for and monitor the good interest of her neighbors when she was shot down and killed. Or like a man who happened to be in his home, he was a Hmong immigrant, but a United States citizen of the United States of America, who was ripped out of his home, his papers were demanded. He was wearing boxers, Crocs, and a small blanket when they walked him out in around 10 degree weather, which, let me tell you, even Minnesotans think that's cold. One woman who was autistic and on the spectrum, and she was going to her treatments, and she happened to be driving through where there was some protests, they ripped her out of the car and applied unnecessary and unreasonable force to her. And there's a whole lot more stories than I can tell. What is the sum total of it all? This dramatic escalation has resulted in harm to our economy. Workers aren't going to work. Consumers aren't going to buy things. Restaurants are empty. Schools, attendance is way down. In places like the Mercado Central and other places that have been revitalized by new Americans are just like a ghost town. And restaurants, some of them have had to close because of the federal government. And now the federal government is threatening the Insurrection Act. Our local police are doing a fantastic job. Even some of them have been stopped and harassed by these ICE agents because they're Somali or they're Latino or they're Hmong. And as a result, metropolitan chiefs of police have had to do press statements demanding that ICE respect people because their own officers are being impacted. And so that's what's going on in my town right now. We filed a lawsuit and we have support from colleagues. And on the 23rd of January, we will be asking a court to put in place guardrails to make the federal government obey the law, to obey the Administrative Procedures Act, to obey the equal sovereignty of the state of Minnesota, to obey our First Amendment right to be a blue state. Because the president has said that he's upset with us because no Republican has won the state of Minnesota since Nixon, but he won it three times, but us officials denied him his victory, which is absolutely delusional. And so this is the situation that we're in. So I'm here in Oregon, been on the phone with folks in Minnesota, But we as AGs have to tell the story of how AGs have been standing up, protecting the rule of law for the last year together. And I wanted to say, what does the year to come mean? It means we're going to stand up for the rule of law. We're going to stand up for our states. We're going to stand up together. And we're going to do election protection. We're already talking about that because we are concerned about free, fair elections this coming November. We're going to protect the right to protest peacefully. And we're going to protect the right to the press, quite honestly, because many of them have complained of being sprayed with chemical irritants and mistreated in various ways. So that's what's going on. I'm here because I want to be with my colleagues to help tell the story on how we are protecting our state against what can only fairly be described as a federal invasion. As a prosecutor, it would be irresponsible and wrong for me to make a conclusory statement about the outcome of the Renee Good death investigation. But I will make a few observations that I hope people pay attention to. One is that her life was precious and she had every right to keep her life. Number two is that the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Department has said that they will not investigate her death. There is no death investigation, use of force death investigation going on by DOJ Civil Rights right now. And four Department of Justice Civil Rights people have quit over this, and six of them have quit in the local U.S. Attorney's Office because they have been told they have to investigate Renee Good's wife, not her death. So the federal government is investigating me and others, but they're not investigating the person who killed Renee Good. And I'm not even saying what the outcome of that investigation should be. No prosecutor should ever say what an investigation should result in before the investigation is completed. But it is disturbing that they're not even investigating at all. And we've seen our colleague Tish James investigated. We've seen James Comey. We've seen Jerome Powell. We've seen Eric Mark Kelly. We've seen Elise Slotkin. And the through line seems to be that if Trump's mad at you, he's going to use the DOJ to investigate you. And if he's not mad at you, he's going to, I don't know, he's pardoned about 1,400 people who tried to overthrow the government. Plus, I don't know how many fraudsters who've stolen from the government. Oh, not to mention Juan Orlando Hernandez, who pushed 400 tons of cocaine inside the United States. So that's not the rule of law. When if you're my friend, I'd help you. And if you're not my friend, I punish you with the rule of law.
A new report shows Native mothers in the Pacific Northwest have a much greater risk of dying during pregnancy. Isabel Charlet has the story.
The highest risk factor for maternal mortality in Washington state is to be American Indian or Alaska Native. That's according to a new report from the Washington Department of Health's Maternal Mortality Review Panel. The panel found the risk of dying from pregnancy-related causes is more than 7 times higher for Native Americans than non-Hispanic white Washingtonians. Cindy Gamble has represented the American Indian Health Commission on the panel for about 8 years. She says the report reflects the continued harm of colonization and a loss of traditional forms of care and community.
From 6 weeks to a year after birth is where almost half of the deaths occur. So that speaks to the support that young families need. They need a lot more support than they are receiving.
The report issues recommendations for the legislature, healthcare systems, and providers focused on improving care quality and access. It also calls for strengthening community support and ensuring equitable, culturally responsive care. Gamble says she was shocked to learn that over 80% of the maternal deaths in the state were preventable, with behavioral health issues like overdose, suicide, and homicide accounting for nearly half. Despite the grim outlook, however, she remains optimistic, noting that the state health department has intentionally recruited people from impacted communities to be on the panel.
Tribes are very adamant about moving forward and coming up with tribal-led programs and solutions so that we can start to erase these disparities for our people.
Gamble adds that along with state and tribal policy, community-level work is also essential. She notes that tribes and grassroots birth justice groups across the state are bringing back traditional birthing and parenting practices to heal from the impacts of colonization, as well as ongoing racism and discrimination. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden links civil rights struggles of the past and present at this week's Martin Luther King Jr. Urban League event in Portland.
This year, we celebrate everything Dr. King stood for, but we note that there's a quirk in the calendar because it falls on the date of Donald Trump's 1 year anniversary. Now, I want to start by way of saying I'm looking around the room and I'm seeing a lot of people who
who aren't in the business of despondency. And Dr. King had a better future. So I'm going to start by saying he insisted we must refuse to believe that the bank of justice is bankrupt. We don't buy it. And it's increasingly important because there's a big gap between folks of modest means and folks at the top. And Senator Merkley and I are spending a lot of time taking on the billionaires because we think everybody ought to have a chance to get ahead, and that's what Dr. King stood for. Now, history reminds us that we've had plenty of dire times. Remember the schools, the buses, the lunch counters, rogue law enforcement attacking peaceful protesters seeking civil rights. Does that sound a little familiar about Minnesota? Of course it is. But Dr. King had an audacious faith in the future. We had wins in Brown versus Board of Education, on the buses of Montgomery, on lunch counters across the South. And the future looked dire, but he stepped up. And I'm here really to tell you, and it's clear that the underpinnings of Dr. King's faith are alive in this room. And the way we're going to advance is through persistent nonviolence. Respect all the voices, regardless of how you look, how you think, how much money you make. Nonviolence is the key to the First Amendment. And what it means is we're going to show up peacefully. We're going to stay out there until we prove that our cause is just. And we are going to exercise the muscle that's all about the First Amendment. So the road isn't going to be easy. But the days ahead are all about an audacious future. And I want you to know, when I walk out of here today, I'm going to be marching out with you in every sense of the word. God bless.
A new report from a nonprofit called the Climate Center outlines a growing effort to remove carbon from the atmosphere on the West Coast and make some recommendations on how to fund and scale them up. Suzanne Potter has the story.
If California is going to slow climate change, experts say we'll need to reduce carbon emissions and remove carbon from the atmosphere. So, climate advocates are calling for more funding and oversight of carbon dioxide removal, or CDR. A new report from the Climate Center divides CDR into nature-based, hybrid, and industrial solutions. Katie Webb with the Climate Center says we need to scale up nature-based solutions, like planting trees and restoring coastal ecosystems.
Nature-based solutions provide so many co-benefits with cleaner air, cleaner water. These will act as a stopgap to create resiliency that California communities will need as we continue to see the climate change.
Hybrid solutions include projects to crush rocks and spread them out to speed up the weathering process, which draws down carbon. Industrial solutions could involve direct air capture, which uses machines to move air over a material that reacts with the atmospheric carbon dioxide, then separates it for storage. Diane Doucette with the nonprofit Project 2030 says people should participate in upcoming efforts by the California Air Resources Board to develop protocols for carbon dioxide removal.
What that means is they'll be determining how carbon dioxide removal is measured, verified, monitored, and accounted for in a way that and really does reduce carbon in the atmosphere. And we want to make sure they're done safely. Somebody's monitoring them.
The protocol will make it possible for companies that run CDR projects to generate carbon credits in the future. The state has invested close to $9 billion in nature-based CDR since 2021, and California allocated $2.8 billion from the State Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund to contribute to the effort. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Trump backs off tariffs and threats of invasion with a new framework for a deal on Greenland. A report finds pros and cons in the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, and some ICE tactics draw academic interest. For the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2026 Talks.
No nation or group of nations is in any position to be able to secure Greenland other than the United States. We're a great power, much greater than people even understand. I think they found that out 2 weeks ago in Venezuela.
President Donald Trump announced he'd reached a framework for a deal with NATO regarding Greenland and backed away from threats of tariffs on European allies. He has also said the U.S. would not use military force. The White House has announced few framework details, and world leaders say they remain leery. In a World Economic Forum speech, Trump insisted the Danish territory, which he mistakenly called Iceland, is still vital to U.S. national security. Stock markets rose on news of proposed tariffs not going into effect. Polls show U.S. voters oppose taking Greenland by 3-1 or more. The president also brought his 2020 election fraud claims to the international stage, saying, quote, people will soon be prosecuted for what they did. The Department of Justice is seeking to force Fulton County, Georgia, to turn over 2020 election ballots, and about a quarter of Americans have said they feel the election was stolen. But numerous legal cases alleging fraud have failed, and critics say Trump's comments now are another example of him seeking retribution against his opponents. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney says the economic upheaval caused by the Trump administration signals a rupture in the, quote, rules-based order.
Great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons, tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited.
Carney has responded to the trade conflicts by working to move Canada's economy from being as reliant on the U.S. Ottawa has signed a deal with China to slash import duties on electric vehicles, contradicting Washington's trade stance. This comes as the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement comes up for review this year. Trump has often called it a, quote, terrible deal in spite of his signing it during his first term. A new report from the Union-Friendly Economic Policy Institute supports that view, saying the U.S. trade deficit with the two countries reached more than $250 billion in 2025, up from $125 billion in 2020. Report author and economist Adam Hirsch says the agreement needs to be rebalanced, and not in a way some would assume.
It's not about rebalancing it between the U.S. and Canada or the U.S. and Mexico. It's about rebalancing it between the power of big corporations that has been written into these rules and what's good for regular people.
Controversial ICE arrests, often captured on cell phone recordings and sparking responses from concerned neighbors, are now drawing study by social scientists. Republicans who back the operation say community resistance is what's inflaming conflicts and making the situation more dangerous. But Minneapolis sociologist Nicole Badera says research shows the opposite is actually true.
The reality is things like ICE Watch and mutual aid are de-escalation tactics, that they are ways of reducing violence, and that even though they do come with some risk, those risks are minimal in comparison to the risk of doing nothing.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Alaska Federation of Natives aims to block a Safari Club International subsistence board plan, and Spokane colleges get seed grants for Indigenous knowledge centers. Antonia Gonzalez has today's edition of National Native News.
The Alaska Federation of Natives is pulling out all the stops to block a Safari Club International proposal to reform the Federal Subsistence Board. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, AFN says it's a direct threat to the Alaska Native subsistence way of life.
Last year, Safari Club International, a sport hunting and fishing group, petitioned two Trump cabinet members for the review. It asked Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins to address what it calls federal overreach in subsistence management. In December, the Interior Department granted the request and announced a 60-day review called a scoping process. During this time, it will consider the Safari Club's recommendations, which includes a proposal to limit the size of the Federal Subsistence Board to only the heads of five federal agencies. Ben Malott, president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, says this would eliminate public seats, including three held by tribal representatives.
We have been working for that for a very long time, so we are concerned that any rollback in public member seats would just weaken our voices. And so for us, that is a major threat.
But beyond changing the leadership structure of subsistence management, the Safari Club calls on federal agency heads when setting regulations to defer to state managers, a move that opponents say would undermine the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, legislation Congress passed 45 years ago to protect Alaska's rural subsistence lifestyle. John Sturgeon, a leading advocate for the Alaska Safari Club, says this is a fight about fish and game management, not about the rights of rural Alaskans to subsist.
We have no problem with subsistence. We support it. So it's a perceived conflict because we just think the state of Alaska should be the one that's in charge of subsistence.
The problem is the state's constitution does not allow for a rural subsistence priority, which federal law mandates. Public comment on the Safari Club proposals closes on February 13th. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Indigenous Knowledge Focus Centers are on their way to Spokane Falls Community College and the Spokane Community College campus on the Spokane Reservation in Washington. As Steve Jackson reports, a grant from Avista Utilities is providing the seed money.
The Indigenous Healing Environments Across Lifeways, or IHEAL centers, will hold workshops on skills and concepts related to sustainability, water, land, animals, and climate. They'll also include studies related to using plants for food and medicine. Spokane College's Tribal Relations Director, Naomi Bender, says she will seek out Indigenous presenters from tribes in the region. But she says instructors will be careful in what they present.
Traditional knowledge of plants and medicines, for example, was illegal in the United States. And to this day, we're very careful about what's actually shared and what's not, because people want to monetize and want to harm with what knowledge they gain at times.
Bender says both Indigenous and non-Native students will be welcome at the IHEAL centers. She anticipates they'll begin holding workshops in about a year. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
Congress recently approved more than $13 million in federal funding for the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for fiscal year 2026. This comes after the Trump administration's proposal to eliminate IAIA's federal appropriation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Glad to have you with us here in the KBOO Evening News on this Thursday, January 22nd, 2026.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Josh Salem, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath.